Naturally Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Naturally Speaking Shorts, where you can get a small insight into the work going on at the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine. I'm James Bergen. Joining me, we have Ian Ramsey, Professor of Small Animal Medicine at the University of Glasgow. Hi Ian, and welcome to Naturally Speaking Shorts.
Hi James.
So Ian, you've just given a talk to the Institute on canine Cushing's disease. How did it go?
I think it went okay. Yeah, I don't know.
I thought it was very interesting. I was actually interested in this talk for personal reasons as well. I haven't actually mentioned to you yet. About a year ago, my dog, my childhood best friend, was actually diagnosed with canine Cushing's disease.
All right, yes.
But I'm somewhat ashamed to say that until your talk, I didn't actually know that much about it. Mm-hmm. What exactly is Cushing's?
Right, well, Cushing's disease is an overproduction of the body steroids. We all have steroids in our bodies as a normal thing. We need them. It's part of our coping mechanisms with the stresses of life, with balancing our intake and output of energy. In a dog with Cushing's, there is an overproduction of steroids, most commonly due to a small nodule at the base of the brain releasing a hormone that stimulates the adrenal glands to produce steroids. So we have an overproduction of steroids. And that causes dogs, when they overproduce steroids, to eat more, drink more, urinate, and lose their fur. As the major signs. There are some other signs, but those are the major signs. And in the long run, they start to develop complications of diabetes and inflammation of the pancreas, which is pancreatitis.
Perhaps you could explain to us a little bit about your work with canine Cushing's disease and the wider work that you do.
Right, okay. Well, I'll start with the second bit first. My wider work is I'm a vet. I work in a specialist hospital where I see 200-400 dogs a year with clinical problems. Myself and my team in the hospital will see several thousand animals every year, referred in from private vets because the animals are particularly sick and their problems need specialist care and treatment. A good number of those dogs have Cushing's disease.
You said in your talk 10,000 dogs in the UK.
There are 10,000 dogs in the UK currently receiving medication for Cushing's disease, so let's hope that they're all got Cushing's disease. So so that's the sort of numbers that we're talking about, and we will see dogs referred in because they have Cushing's disease, or they're referred in with a problem and we discover that that problem is due to Cushing's disease. So we both treat it and diagnose it. And that's my job.
And you kind of occupy that somewhat special area between practicing veterinary medicine and also some scientific research as well.
Yes. So I spend a lot of time treating animals, but I also try to use the information that I get when I'm treating those animals to do two things. One is to teach vets and vet students, and the second is to try to make things better for the patients so that we find new ways of doing things.
And what kind of led you to this path? Was it a very sort of natural thing from a very young age? This is kind of what you wanted to do and it progressed?
Well, the veterinary side was my first calling is as a vet. And that came because I've always loved animals. I mean, it's trite to say, but I've always loved animals. I've always had cats at home and more recently, dogs. And I enjoy working with them. I enjoy working with the people who own cats and dogs. So it was a very natural calling for somebody who also had a biological bent, as it were, at school to become a vet. What led me down this particular pathway of vets, unusual for a vet, many vets go out into practice to spend as much time as they can treating animals. But during my university career as an undergraduate, I discovered I had a particular joy of studying things in great detail and really focusing down and going into the literature and looking at the problem and trying to make sense and realizing that there were things that people were saying which weren't necessarily always true, and finding out that actually, and there's, you know, that we could find better solutions. And I was very inspired by one particular person at the University of Liverpool who was showing how things were different, and I always thought, yes, that was the sort of vet I wanted to be. So when I qualified as a vet, although I spent some time in practice, the PhD was the logical progression. So I went to do a PhD, and that's when I came up to Glasgow.
Okay. So most people within this institute would kind of understand that sort of strong desire to study something very much in detail.
Mm-hmm.
What might not be that common is this interaction with the general public.
Mm-hmm.
And what's that like? Is it an enjoyable aspect of your working career?
I spend 75% of my time with the public treating their dog. The research is a sideline. And that's perhaps what other people in the university don't understand, is that
totally.
Only a very small part of my life is research. It's almost a hobby on the side. I can't spend too much time doing research. My focus has to be the patients, and that's where my primary driving goal comes from. I think the research has led to a situation, though, where I become known for managing this particular disease. So my researches on Cushing's over the years have led to the situation where people send me dogs with Cushing's and talk to me about it. And I get three or four phone calls a day from people in practice, vets in practice, wanting to know how to help a dog with Cushing's. So I deal with a lot of Cushing or dogs, and that feeds into your research. So the two live, there's a symbiosis there. One feeds the other.
So the Cushing's disease really very much is the sort of pinnacle of your research. It's kind of the most important aspect of what you've done.
Undoubtedly. The development of a new drug, which has replaced the old drug now across the world, has consumed vast quantities of my time. And that has been the driving thing with colleagues in London, in Bristol, in Liverpool. It was a team effort amongst, but it was a UK effort, and it was the UK that led the field right from the word go, and still leads the field on the use of this drug. But your dog with Cushing's. Your dog with Cushing's.
Yes, I have a dog with Cushing's.
Right, and on treatment.
He is on treatment. I can't remember exactly what drug it is.
It will be triazine.
It will be, yeah. But he had all of the clinical conditions you were talking about. He lost all of his hair. He drank a lot. He peed a lot, which was very unpleasant.
Yes.
He got very rotund. His body went a bit like a barrel shape.
Yes. It's
very worrying.
Okay, so what breed?
He is a Patterdale Terrier.
Okay, yes.
Patterdale
Terriers are one of the, so they're sort of fairly predisposed because they're small terriers, and for some reason small terriers seem to get Cushing's more often, and it tends to be the pituitary form of the disease rather than the more serious adrenal form of the disease. When you get an adrenal tumour, that's more serious. The life expectancy is much shorter.
You said in your talk you've been researching this for really quite a long time now.
Mm-hmm.
So are there still really very big questions to go? Are you just filling in the gaps, or is there some really major aspects that you still need to try and understand?
There's a huge aspect which I think needs to be addressed, which is why dogs get Cushing's. I mean, we have many more cases of Cushing's than our human medical equivalents. And it is clearly in some dogs, it runs in families of these dogs, therefore suggesting that there is probably an inherited component. So the big unanswered question is, what are the factors that lead to a dog developing Cushing's? And that's something that is very hard for me to study in the clinic, because I see the result of that problem. There needs to be work going on earlier on in the dog's life to try to identify markers that would then lead to the development of tests that we could predict the development of Cushing's, and we are light years away from that.
So I guess one aspect with your daily working life and your research that we might not encounter quite so much is the ethics side of it.
Mm-hmm.
So ethics is something I find personally very interesting. I obviously come across it every now and then. I work with live animals myself, but not quite to the same extent. Do you often have conflicts with, say, experimental designs and what you ethically can do and what would be ideal for investigating diseases like Cushing's and what in real life you actually have?
I think it's true to say that we always have to think about the individual animal's benefit and welfare. So I am not allowed, nobody is allowed, to do anything to an animal that is not for that animal's benefit without ethical approval. And in the case of client-owned animals, you obviously need to discuss anything like that with the client as well. So there is ethical oversight at university level, at national level. So there are laws in place that will stop you. Those ethical oversight comes from the Home Office and the Animal Welfare, the Animals Act, but it also comes in this particular instance from the Veterinary Medicines Act and what we can do with medicines as well in animals. So, for example, we cannot take an extra sample of blood from a dog just because we're interested. It has got to be something that is for that animal's benefit, directly benefit. And therefore, some of the studies that one would love to do, as it were, which would, for example, involve taking multiple blood samples from a dog, which is affected, we would not be allowed to do unless we had a license from the Home Office in order to do this, and then it would all have to be discussed with the owners. And in all honesty, not many owners would be willing to let us do it. So the answer is, I don't hold a Home Office license, so I don't. Nothing I do to a dog is not for that dog's direct benefit. I always act in the dog's direct benefit, and I simply accept that constraint therefore use the information that I do have.
And you have been involved with sort of testing the efficiency of drugs, these kind of things?
Yes, in the sense that we had drugs that were new, that we knew worked on one or two dogs, and then it comes down to a discussion with the owner as about whether they want the old, known to be unsafe drug, or the new, slightly less well-known drug, and trying to balance up those two. There are rules about drugs that are currently licensed, but we, at the time that we started using trilastine, which is the drug we're talking about, there were no licensed drugs. Now that trilastine is licensed, it would be very hard to come with a new drug and say, okay, we're going to try the new drug instead of trilastine. You would have to have a test certificate to do that, and a lot of consent and all the rest to do that when there is a pre-existing drug licensed.
Okay, perfect. So, as we're coming to the end of our Naturally Speaking Shorts, we'll have a couple of short questions, which maybe we can get your opinions on.
Okay.
So, what about your field do you wish that everyone knew? Like, what in your veterinary medicine or your scientific research do you just wish that everyone...
Well, if you're talking about every dog owner, I wish they all knew the signs of Cushing's so that they would bring their dogs in soon. It's the ones that are left without treatment for a long time. They are the ones that have difficulty. So... go to your vet if your dog is drinking more, urinating more, losing its fur. It's not normal. Go to your vet. So that would be the simple take-home message.
If your dog starts behaving abnormally, go to the vet.
Yes. And particularly looking at the thirst. And looking at the thirst. It's crucial, you know.
Perfect. And what would your advice be to young people just sort of getting on the same sort of path as you? So say you're
a young vet or a young... person well, before
how,
they
how
get
about
to
both?
Vet.
How about a high school student, not sure whether or not to do vet med or zoology, or an undergraduate student who's not sure whether or not to do a PhD?
Okay, I think it's important that if you want to be a vet, you go spend time with a vet, because a love for animals only gets you so far. You have also got to be prepared to intervene on an animal's behalf to help that animal, and sometimes that will involve issues like surgery and anesthesia and so forth, which are, even you know, for animal lovers, can be quite traumatic experiences. So I think it's vital that before you go and spend time, before you start on a veterinary course in your life, that you try to spend time with a vet to decide if this is for you, because it is a vocation. It is a job that you will do for 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. You know, that is the sort of demands that are made on you as a vet, and if you aren't enjoying it, it's no fun for anyone. If you like studying animals, then zoology is a good course. You know, it's about the study of animals, you don't actually have to be nasty to be kind, as it were, to animals. So I think, you know, being able to pick up a scalpel and stomach that is an important lesson before you get down into the veterinary world. Now, if on the other hand, you are already a vet and you're deciding whether you want to go into practice or do a PhD or do a specialist, my simple advice is to you to think what 40 years feels like. Just stop and think, because 40 years doing the same job, and you know that's what many vets do is a hard call. And having the joy of what I've done is that I have an enormously varied lifestyle. Sometimes I'm a vet, sometimes a researcher, sometimes I'm a teacher. And that variety comes from having a career that has developed in a flexible way, and not being prepared to take a leap. And I'd say that to all undergraduates. For goodness sake, go take a leap. You know, there's no bad experience after you qualify, except where you don't take a leap and try and be a little bit brave and think beyond. Don't listen to what everyone else is saying as a thing. It may not be right for you. Get out there and do something amazing.
I would agree. You should always be a little bit scared about what you want to do after uni.
Yes.
It would be more rewarding.
Yes.
Okay, perfect. So we will end there, but just on one final thought. So you have your veterinary clinical side and you have your research side. Which is more rewarding? Being able to save, say, an individual dog's life, or being involved in a large research project, which could
have some big impacts? Oh, definitely the dog's life. I always choose the dog over the research.
I think that's the right answer. Thank you very much for joining us, Ian, and all the best with your future work. I'm James Bergen, and this has been Naturally Speaking Shorts. Tune in next time.
Thanks for listening to the Naturally Speaking podcast. If you've got any ideas for future shows or want to get involved, then please contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is naturallyspeakingpodcast@gmail.com. Naturally Speaking is a podcast from the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine at the University of Glasgow. For more information, you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at the NS Podcast. And you can download future episodes and find more information at our blog at naturallyspeakingpodcast.wordpress.com.